If you like a good murder mystery, here's one for you. Back in 1987, at the annual convention of the American Association of Forensic Scientists, the then president of the association shared this story. On March 23rd, 1987, a man named Ronald Opus was found dead. It seems he climbed to the top of a 12-story condo building and jumped off of it. Later, investigators found a note that he had left behind expressing his despondency. All this taken together seemed to be a clear open and cut case of suicide. But not so fast, because it turns out the jump is not what killed Ronald Opus. After he jumped off the top of the building, as he was hurtling downward, a shot rang out inside the condo building from the ninth floor, the bullet piercing the window, and as Ronald Opus whisked past, the bullet struck him in the head, killing him instantly. But for that bullet, Ronald Opus would not have died, because unbeknownst to him, workers had erected a safety net below the eighth floor as they washed windows there. So Opus' body fell into the net, but he was already dead from the gunshot wound. So what at first seemed like an open and shut case of suicide now becomes a case of homicide. But who did it? Further investigation revealed that an old man and an old woman lived in a condo on the ninth floor, and at the time had been in the midst of a furious argument, so much so that the old man pulled his gun out of the closet, pointed at his wife, fired, and missed. The bullet went through the window and struck Opus in the head. So now we know who is responsible for the murder. It was the old man in the condo. But not so fast. Because when the old man was questioned, he and his wife both swore that when they fought, which was often, that it was the husband's habit to pull his gun out of the closet, point it at her, click the trigger, but they both knew it was not loaded. So now, what originally seemed to be a suicide that then became a homicide suddenly becomes an accidental killing. But not so fast. If the old man didn't load the gun, who did? Investigators found a witness who told them that the son of the old man and old woman told her that 6 weeks earlier, he and his mom, the old woman, had a huge fight in which she told him, the son, that she was cutting him off financially. He, the son, grew so angry that he decided to exact revenge on his mother, and he knew exactly how to do it. He knew that when his mother and father were fighting, which was frequently, that his father would pull the gun out, pull it at her, point it at his mother, and pull the trigger, and so it was the son who secretly loaded the gun. Now we know who's responsible for the murder, the son of the old man and the old woman. But not so fast. Hey, you're tracking with me here, Byron. Not so fast, because in the strangest twist of all, it turns out, the witness went on to tell the investigators, that the son then waited for his mom and dad to have another argument. A week passed and there was no argument. 2 weeks, no argument. 3 weeks, no argument. This was so strange, so unusual for them. 4 weeks, 5 weeks, this whole time the son is cut off financially. He's growing more and more desperate financially, so that by the sixth week, still no fight, the son climbs up to the top of the condo building and jumps off. So that now you figured it out, right? How strange. The son of the old man and the old woman was none other than Ronald Opus, who jumped off the building and ended up being killed by the bullet that he himself had placed in his father's gun So that brings us full circle now, all the way back to death by suicide. Now, that hypothetical story, by the way, that the president of the Association of American Forensic Scientists told at the convention in 1987 has been circulating ever since and went viral online because it is such a vivid reminder to investigators everywhere that when you are investigating a murder, it is critically important that you do not jump to conclusions, that you leave no stone unturned, that you examine the case from every possible angle. As you know, we here at Life Journey are in the midst of an investigative sermon series called Who Killed Jesus? The objective of this sermon series is to see if we can figure out who bears ultimate responsibility for the death of Jesus. We've already looked at the most obvious suspects, Pontius Pilate, Judas Iscariot, the institutional religious leaders in Jesus' day. And last week, we went on to even dare to ask whether God the Father might bear any responsibility for the death of his son. Now today, we're going to ask an even more provocative question. And please understand, with these questions, I mean no disrespect. It's just that when you dare to ask blunt questions, you sometimes can gain deep insights. So today's question is it possible that Jesus himself was ultimately responsible for his own death? That may sound like an odd question to you, but let's say a prayer, and then I'll explain why I would even ask such a thing. Let's pray. God, the death of Jesus is at the heart of our Christian faith. So much so that the cross is the ultimate symbol of our faith. If we're going to understand Jesus, we've got to understand his death. So today, take us deeper than ever before in our understanding of why Jesus had to die. We ask this in his holy name. Amen. Long before Jesus died, he began talking about his death. It's one of the most fascinating aspects of the story of the life of Jesus. He kept predicting his own demise. Barely halfway through the Gospel of Matthew, right after Simon Peter confessed that he believed Jesus to be the long-awaited Messiah, Matthew tells us, Matthew 16:21, from that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the chief priests and the scribes and be killed. Nor was this a one-off occurrence. Again and again, as his ministry continued to unfold, Jesus kept coming back to this point, reminding his disciples that his death was imminent. We saw another example of that in our gospel reading that Duana shared with us a few minutes ago. John 10:11. Jesus said, I am the good shepherd. And the good shepherd what? Lays down his life for the sheep. When Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane, as soldiers were coming to arrest him, Simon Peter pulled his sword to defend Jesus. Jesus told Peter to put up the sword, and Jesus went on to say, Matthew 26:53, do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, who will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? Jesus could have just given the word, and God would have sent 10,000 angels to whisk him away, to deliver him from his death. Yet for some reason, with all of that power, all he had to do was ask. With all of that at his fingertips, Jesus did not call for those angels. It's almost as if he wanted to die or thought he had to die. In fact, at his trial before Pontius Pilate, as Pilate asked Jesus critical questions, Jesus stood in silence, refusing to answer, refusing to mount any reasonable defense. Did he have a death wish? What was going on here? In our gospel passage today, at the very end of it, Jesus made perhaps his most explicit statement. There he said, John 10:17, "For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord." Don't miss that last sentence. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. And there, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you have it, straight from the lips of the witness himself. Nobody had the power to take Jesus' life from him. He, of his own voluntary accord, gave his life. And when you start to put all of this together, it becomes abundantly apparent that Jesus believed in his heart of hearts that his death was both inevitable and necessary. Why? If we're going to be followers of Jesus, if we're going to put our faith in Jesus, we need to understand why. There are, I believe, at least four critical reasons why Jesus believed his death was both necessary and inevitable. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, God help us, Jeff's normal three-point sermon has multiplied into four. We're going to miss the Colts game. We're going to miss lunch. Not going to be able to mow the yard today. We're going to be here all day. Do not despair. Because an angel of the Lord came to me in a dream this week and said to me, "You will not preach a four-point sermon. Save the fourth point." Yeah, praise God, right? Save the fourth point for next Sunday. So that's what we're going to do. So don't worry. You will get to see the Colts lose today, I promise. I just calls them as I sees them, all right? Remember last year? I'm just saying. So you'll get to see the game, have your lunch, mow your yard, because next Sunday we're going to look at the fourth reason why Jesus' death was inevitable. It's the most common reason stated for the death of Jesus, that Jesus had to die to pay for our sins. That statement, you've probably heard it so many times, it goes right over here, but that statement, if you think about it, raises all kinds of questions that we'll dig into next week. But for this week, we're going to look at three additional critical reasons why Jesus had to die. Three reasons that you seldom hear stated, but that are critically important. So first, for starters, Jesus understood, as Pastor David mentioned in the family moment earlier, Jesus understood that the message he came to deliver, the truth he came to share, was so hot, was so revolutionary, was so disruptive of the status quo, that the powers that be, the defenders of the status quo, would inevitably reach the conclusion that we either stop him or he will stop us. Jesus knew that his message was so hot, it would eventually result in his demise if he was going to boldly share that message. This is, by the way, a phenomenon that is not foreign to us in our lives in more ordinary and lesser ways. We all know an experience or many experiences in our life where we needed to deliver a challenging message to someone, and then that someone wants to shoot the messenger, right? That's often the way it works in this world, and we experience it all the time. An efficiency expert was wrapping up a lecture to a group of college students going for their business degrees, and at the end of this lecture, the efficiency expert warned these students, "Now, I would not recommend that you practice any of these efficiency techniques at home." One of the students said, "Well, why not?" The efficiency expert said, "Well, let me give you a practical example." He says, "For years, I observed my wife as she prepared breakfast in the morning each day the same way. I would watch as she would go from the refrigerator to the cabinet to the stove to the table, usually carrying just one thing at a time. So," he said, "one day I said to my wife, 'Honey, You could save a lot of time if you would carry several things at once. The student said, well, did it save time? Yes, the efficiency expert said. It used to take my wife 20 minutes to prepare my breakfast. Now I do it in 7. When we have a difficult message to deliver, you can count on it. There's going to be blowback. There will be consequences. And sometimes we experience that in simple, non-consequential ways. But when you are talking about big stuff, challenging foundational norms and prejudices of culture and institutional religion, you can bet your life, no pun intended, that if you go forward with that message courageously and in uncompromising fashion, you will pay a price. Ask any reformer and they will tell you. Ask Razia Jan about the consequences for the message that she was put here on earth to deliver. Razia Jan was born in Afghanistan. As a student, she came to the United States to study, and after she graduated, she decided to stay here. She became an American citizen. She raised a son. She opened a small business. Then came September 11, 2001, and she saw such devastation wreaked on her adopted nation from terrorists based in her native country. She was devastated by this. How can people do this to people? And she felt like she had to do something about it. So she launched a nonprofit that focused on meeting the needs of 9/11 victims, U.S. soldiers, and children in Afghanistan. Several years later, in 2008, after she had made several trips back and forth from Afghanistan to aid children in Afghanistan, she began to feel like she was getting clearer and clearer on what was the problem with her native country, why the culture there was so dysfunctional and so aggressive. And she concluded that the reason Afghanistan was such a mess is because for millennia, Afghanistan has suppressed its women, refusing even to educate little girls, refusing to teach them to read and write. She decided that if the women of Afghanistan could be empowered, it would transform her native land. So she decided she would do something about it. So she made her way back to Afghanistan to live there, and she began a school for girls. And oh, the blowback that came her way. In her own words, she says, people are crazy. The day we opened the school, on the other side of town, several men threw hand grenades into another girls' school, and 100 girls were killed. Can you imagine? Just because people were trying to teach little girls to read and write, somebody thinks, we got to blow up 100 little girls. Every day, Razia says, you'd hear that somebody had thrown acid in a girl's face or poisoned the water at their schools. But Razia was determined. She went ahead and she opened up her school because she had a vision. She puts it this way, my girls can touch the world just by sitting in this school. The knowledge they're gaining is something nobody can ever steal from them. The opposition was incredible, so she built a stone wall, a thick stone wall around her school to protect the girls and the teachers. She hired security guards that would come into the school each morning before the students arrived, pump water out of the well, and then the security guards would taste the water and wait to see if they died. Literally. If they didn't die, they knew that the well had not been poisoned and they could serve the water to the girls that day. I mean, can you imagine? Talk about the empire strikes back. On the very first day that Razia opened her school, 4 threatening men came to visit her. They said to her, this is your last chance to change the school into a boys' school because the backbone of Afghanistan is our boys. Razia says, I turned and looked them in the eye and said, excuse me, women are the eyesight of Afghanistan, and unfortunately, you all are blind, and I really want to give you some sight. And when you think about it, that is exactly what Jesus came to do on an even grander scale. He came to give us our sight. He came to create revolutionary change. He came to create such significant change that he knew that he was touching on and challenging foundational principles, foundational prejudices of culture and institutional religion in his day, to the extent that he knew if he didn't pull back on his message, they were bound to get him. At that time, women disciples were unheard of. So what did Jesus do? He called women to be his disciples. Mary Magdalene, Susanna, Joanna, to name a few. That was provocative. Back then, at that time, the Samaritans were a hated racial minority. So what did Jesus do? He made a Samaritan the spiritual hero of his most famous parable, the parable of the Good Samaritan. That was provocative. Back at that time, institutional religion conventionally excluded social outcasts, so-called sinners and unclean people. So what did Jesus do? Jesus graciously welcomed sinners and unclean people into his spiritual community as equals. That was revolutionary, provocative. He was poking the beast at Jesus' time and in his culture. People that we today would call gay were universally hated and despised. And so what did Jesus do? In Matthew chapter 8, he performed a miracle healing and saving the life of the partner of a gay Roman centurion. Talk about poking the beast. Talk about being provocative. Jesus wasn't going to pull back on his universal message of grace. At that time, institutional religion was rule-based and focused on earning the favor of God. Along comes Jesus with a message of spiritual grace. We are saved by grace through faith. And in so doing, in so preaching this message, Jesus was threatening to strip the institutional religious leaders of the power that they held to be gatekeepers. They stood between people and God Almighty. And so it was inevitable. Jesus could see it coming. He was challenging such foundational prejudices of culture and religion. It was inevitable that these institutional defenders of the status quo were going to conclude, we either stop him or he stops us. The cross was the foreseeable culmination of all of the anger that had been building against Jesus, so that on the cross, Jesus, as it were, took into his body all of the anger of the defenders of the status quo, past, present, and future. Jesus did it. He did it anyway, knowing what was coming, because it was worth it. We, you and I, were worth it to him. He came to create change that would set us free, whatever the consequence. This then is the first reason why Jesus believed that his death was inevitable and necessary. It was the foreseeable natural reaction to his explosive message, "The Empire Strikes Back." But it doesn't stop there. Because you see, Jesus intuitively understood the power of a death to turbocharge a movement. Think about it. If history teaches us anything, it's that when a great leader is struck down, that doesn't stop them. That only makes them more powerful. When a great leader is assassinated, it's as if their power is released into the ether to flow, to blow far and wide. Just ask Dr. King or Gandhi or Zelensky in Ukraine with all that he's facing. Just ask Lincoln. Just ask the nuns of El Salvador in the 1980s when so many of them were being slaughtered for defending their faith and justice. We could even ask Emmett Till. Emmett Till was a 14-year-old black boy who, while on vacation visiting relatives in Mississippi in 1955, was accused of whistling at a white girl. For that, he was nabbed and brutally lynched to death. I recently read an article in the Washington Post about Emmett Till. The story in the Post begins like this. In 1955, when Mamie Till heard the news that her only son had been kidnapped in Mississippi, Mamie and her son lived in Chicago, so he was vacationing in Mississippi. When Mamie heard the news that her only son had been kidnapped in Mississippi, tortured, shot, wrapped in barbed wire, that in turn was tethered to a 75-pound fan, then thrown in the Tallahatchie River. She, Emmett's mother, insisted that the authorities send his body home to Chicago. When she went to the train station to see the body of her 14-year-old son, she collapsed. His body was swollen beyond recognition. His teeth were missing. His ear was severed. His eye was hanging out. The only thing that identified him was his ring. The empire was striking back. In her grief and outrage, Emmett's mother called the Chicago Defender, one of the country's leading black newspapers at the time. She also called Ebony and Jet magazines, telling reporters that she wanted the world to see the barbaric act committed against her son by white men in Mississippi. Then, she did something that would change history. She demanded an open casket at her son's funeral, saying, "I think everybody needs to know what happened to my son." So, at a church on the south side of Chicago, Emmett Till's mutilated body was put on display for all to see. 50,000 people in Chicago saw Emmett Till's corpse with their own eyes. The emotional photos of his funeral captured his mom as she approached her son's casket, her body seeming to buckle. Photographers captured her leaning over the casket, to which photos of the smiling boy had been taped inside the lid. The headline in the Jet magazine read, "Negro boy was killed for wolf whistle." When the magazine printed the photos of Emmett's mangled body, it created national outrage, shocking white and black America alike. Emmett Till's death became a catalyst for the civil rights movement. In fact, the headline of the Washington Post article declared, "Emmett Till's mother opened his casket and sparked the civil rights movement." So that you see, in his death, Emmett Till became billions of times more powerful than he had ever been in his brief life. I guess you could call it the power of martyrdom. The sad truth, the tragedy is that it often takes a tragic death to create meaningful change. Jesus understood that principle. Jesus understood that as long as he was physically embodied and present here on this earth, his location would become the center of his ministry and movement. People, everybody would flock to be around Jesus. His disciples wanted to be where Jesus was. Who wouldn't? I would. So Jesus understood that he was going to have to be removed from the scene before his movement would be able to go global. In fact, shortly before his death, Jesus said, Matthew 26:31, smite the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. Jesus understood that when he was smitten, when he would suffer and die, that that would be the catalyst that would release and send his followers to the four winds of the earth, and that would cause his movement to go global. When they crushed Jesus, they thought they were stopping him. Instead, they were making him, unbeknownst to them, billions of times more powerful. When I was a little kid, 5 years old, I was playing in the garage on a warm summer's day when I looked up and I saw a harrowing sight. I saw the biggest, hairiest spider I had ever seen in my life. The spider was, I swear, this is gospel truth, must have been 2 inches in diameter. And that spider was coming across the concrete garage floor right for me. And you know how fast a spider can move when they want to, right? It was coming for me at breakneck speed. So I screamed. I was not back then the manly man that you see before you today. So I screamed bloody murder. And that spider was making a beeline for me at breakneck speed, so reflexively, instinctively, I did the only thing I knew to do to preserve the status quo, my life. I stomped with all my might on that spider. And that's when it got really strange. That's when it became like an episode from the Twilight Zone. Gospel truth, when I stomped on that spider, that big old hairy spider broke into hundreds of tiny replica little spiders, spreading out from under my foot in every direction across the garage floor. So many of them, I could not now stop them. All I could do was turn and run. Because you see, apparently the spider I stomped on was a mama spider at full gestation in pregnancy, and when I stomped on her, I released hundreds of her little babies out into the world, spreading out in every direction, an unstoppable force. Sisters and brothers, when they stomped on Jesus, that's what happened. They thought they were stopping him. In reality, they were making him a billion times more powerful, an unstoppable force. Jesus, after his resurrection, said as much to his disciples. He said, Acts 1:8, you will receive power, and now you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, but not just Jerusalem, in Judea and Samaria, the surrounding regions, and to the ends of the earth. That's Jesus saying, you are now my tiny little spiders, and I send you out to the four winds of the earth. You know what Christian means, right? The etymology of Christian means little Christian, little Jesus. We are those tiny little spiders that have been released into the wild to travel to the four winds of the earth to further the Jesus movement in this world. Jesus understood that. He understood instinctively that his death was necessary to fully release the power of his ministry. This is the second key reason why Jesus believed his death was absolutely necessary, because it was the catalyst that would cause his movement to go viral. It's the power of martyrdom. So that leaves just one more point, because we're saving the fourth for next week. Third point. Jesus understood that his death was necessary if he was going to realize his greatest achievement, conquering death. A Sunday school teacher one morning was quizzing her students to see if they had understood some lessons she had shared with them on how we are saved by grace. So the Sunday school teacher said to her kids, suppose I sold my house, sold my car, had a big garage sale, and then donated all the money to the church. Would that get me into heaven? No, all of her kids called back enthusiastically. Suppose the teacher said, I cleaned the church every day, mowed the yard, and kept everything tidy. Would that get me into heaven? No, the kids said. Suppose she said, I was kind to everybody, gave candy to little kids, and loved my husband well. Would that get me into heaven? No! The kids shouted back, okay, the teacher said, so proud that the kids were getting in. Okay, the teacher said, so what do I have to do to get into heaven? The little boy raised his hand and said, first you gotta be dead. He's got a point, right? If Jesus was going to conquer death, if Jesus was going to rise from the dead, first, he had to die. Knowing that, Jesus fixed his intention on what he knew would be the end of his path. He knew he needed to face death so as to validate the promise he made to us in John 11:25, where he said, I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, though they die, they will live. Jesus knew he had to die and rise again to give us a living hope as we face our own mortality. Because if Jesus rose from the dead, it makes sense that we who follow him will rise like him. I saw a funny picture the other day. It showed a menacing Doberman Pinscher reared up on his back legs looking over a fence. And the sign on the fence said, want to know whether there's life after death? Jump over this fence. Jesus knew that he had to face death so that we wouldn't have to wait until we jump the fence to know if there's anything on the other side. He's already jumped the fence, and he rose. And that now gives us a reasonable confidence, a living faith that we can cling to as we move through life. And that changes everything. Let me close with this. It's a classic story. You may have heard it before, but it really brings home what we're talking about. A pastor went to pay a visit to an elderly woman who was in hospice care. She had asked him to come by so that they could make arrangements for her funeral. So as they sat down and talked, she talked him through her favorite hymns, the songs she wanted sung at her funeral, and the scriptures she wanted read. She shared a few stories about her life so that he could incorporate that into the eulogy and give people a flavor for her life. They talked about the order of the service, planned it all out, and then they closed with a prayer. And as the pastor got up to walk away, she said, oh, pastor, one more thing. I almost forgot. It's the most important thing, she said. When they lay me out in the casket and open the lid and people are going to pass by and pay their last respects, make sure they place a fork in my right hand. What? The pastor said. Why? Well, she said, my whole life I've been going to church potlucks. And at all of our church potlucks, as the main dish is winding up, inevitably volunteers begin to circulate to clear the dishes off the table. And every time, someone would lean over me and say, Martha, keep your fork. And pastor, I knew what that meant. The best was yet to come. I didn't know exactly what it would be, but maybe it would be a deep dish apple pie or a chocolate mocha cheesecake. Whatever it was, I knew that the best was yet to come. So, pastor, as people are passing by my casket, when they ask you, what's with the fork, I want you to simply say to them, remember, the best is yet to come. Someday, you and I will hear a doctor say, I'm sorry, but. Someday, maybe you and I will find ourselves in a vehicle spinning out of control and we'll know this is it. When that time comes for you, remember, keep your fork, because the best is yet to come. It's not the end. It's the beginning of the best. That is why Jesus was so determined to die. It's the third key reason. Jesus was determined to die because he knew that his death would conclusively demonstrate that we too can triumph over death, giving us a living hope. Think about it. Jesus could have avoided death. He could have called 10,000 angels to whisk him away. That would have been great for him. But what about us? Jesus wasn't going to leave us behind. He was determined that he would face death so that when you and I someday face our greatest fear, the end of our physical bodies, when we are standing at death's door, we will be able to face it with a living hope. He rose, and we will rise like him. Pontius Pilate, Judas Iscariot, the institutional religious leaders of Jesus' day, they thought they were calling the shots. It turns out that they were just bit players in a much bigger plan, the divine plan. Nobody had the power to take Jesus' life from him. He chose to die for you and me. As brutal as his death was, in his death, he became 10 billion times more powerful than he had ever been, even in his life. Now I understand why Jesus was so determined that he had to die. Thank you, Good Shepherd, for loving us so much that you laid down your life for us sheep.